This is WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org. I am Eunice Buckner Boone, and this is Higher Ground.
Thank you.
Sorry for the space. The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Oh, okay, I'm here. I'm feeling a little sadness, too, because Prince has died. Well, his body has left the place. I'm trying to think. What else do I want to do? I have announcements I need to read. And again, my name is Eunice Buckner Boone, and I thank you for being with me here today on Higher Ground, my turn. I have a guest in studio, so we will get into my guest, which is Dr. Irvin Williams, Restoration Urban Ministries, organization, agency, community, activist extraordinaire. He's been on my radio program several times, and I was just commenting to him. I said, wow, you know, I can ask you to be on, and generally you say, not generally, I didn't say generally. I said, you'll say yes. You'll find a way to be there. And I just really appreciate that. I really appreciate your support, because that is very supportive. If I think about it, wow. And so, and the things that he has to share about his programs, what's going on with Restoration Urban Ministry, is really worthy of Higher Ground, because Higher Ground is about higher ground. How do we make the most and do better with our lives, with our talents, which really truly gives us purpose? I think about Jackie Robinson. April 15th was Jackie Robinson Day. And Jackie Robinson was not, he was a man, yes, but he was someone who, look, 69 years later, since he integrated baseball, he is still talked about, his family, his wife, Rachel Robinson, is, I think, 93 now. Wonderful. I guess she couldn't marry. She never married after that. I mean, after Jackie Robinson, I don't think I could marry either. Really, they were together, a very powerful couple. And it was because of her strength, which I'm going to play a YouTube video, and I have a tendency to do that for my listeners on Higher Ground, because I find things that are encouraging to me, meaningful to me, on YouTube or whatever, and I want to share them with you. And so you understand the depth of what it means to be. And Rachel Robinson, I found this interview and I thought, wow, this is so powerful, of Jackie Robinson's wife. She was 90 at the time she did this interview. And I think you'll understand more of their relationship by reading the books. Her daughter is an author of children's books as well as other books. And her son is remaining son, David, lives in Africa, where he is part of owns a coffee cooperative, and that's where he chose to live, and he has a life there. But it's all part of their commitment to uplifting. And Reverend Irvin Williams is a person who reminds me of that, of quiet spirit, doing things for others? How can I improve the life of others in a way that they are now improving their own lives? And Jackie Robinson and Rachel Robinson, that was the essence of what they're partnering together as a couple, of course, to improve each other's life, to uplift each other, but at the same time, to uplift people. They're African-American people who were definitely disenfranchised and not having access to fair and equality of resources, but also to uplift people. We can do better kind of thing. And then Prince's death. If you listen to, and it's a lot on the internet about Prince's life, you know that in the 2000-something, Prince became a Jehovah's Witness. And I didn't know that. I knew that he was a Jehovah's Witness because I used to be one. But I knew that Prince also didn't know that his mother was a Jehovah's Witness. So I understood, and Larry Graham, I don't know if you remember Larry Graham, you do, Reverend Williams, with he was with Graham Central Station, and then he went out on his own. He was a Jehovah's Witness too. Did you know that? Did you know that, that George Benson is a Jehovah's Witness? You knew that Michael Jackson and his family were. Serena and Venus Williams, they aren't baptized witness according to what I read here, but they are Jehovah's Witnesses, and Mama's Jehovah's Witness. Dad wasn't. And I'm trying to think, Naomi Sims, the model, she was a Jehovah's Witness, raised one. And so when Prince became a Jehovah's Witness, I was like trying to understand, okay, why? Because I wasn't, and that was a religion that I knew from the time I was born. That was the religion of my mom and my dad, but I would say my mom was the most instrumental in terms of making sure that we followed the teachings and going out and field service, et cetera, et cetera. So I was really kind of surprised that in 2001, I think that's when I learned that Prince was a Jehovah's Witness, and he didn't keep it a secret, but trying to understand. So understanding our path, our journey in life. For me, Prince was very spiritual. I mean, he didn't just sing songs. He was very passionate about the music, and he was very passionate about, I remember seeing him at the Assembly Hall. It was the only time I saw him at the Assembly Hall here in 2000. Oof, I can't remember when that was. But I spent the whole time screaming and jumping up and enjoying it. And he had such a way of being with everyone in the audience. And it was just wonderful. It was a wonderful, wonderful time. And you can tell that this is someone who actually cares. And this is what I also gathered from the interviews that I saw about him and about very thoughtful, reflective individual. And so I can understand, as we continue in our life journey, that we assess and we reflect on where we are at the time and how can we make a better change or make a better change in our life, and how can that be reflected in what we do. And one of the things that Stevie Wonder was saying about Prince was that he was a quiet person about himself. But his music was very loud and spoke a lot about what Prince wanted to share. And that was his love for people. And so, I feel a lot of things, but I'm so thankful that I was able to get, and you say, oh, well, Eunice, how do you connect all this together with Reverend Irvin Williams? It's the same thing, is that we all have Jackie Robinson, Rachel Robinson, Prince, myself, higher ground, all the things that we do. We think about how can we do it better, not better than someone else, but how can we do it better so that the communication is that we care. How can we care for ourselves, deeply care for ourselves, have a deep appreciation for who we are, because it's with that care for our own selves and that awareness of ourselves that we're able to model that and share that with others. And Prince did that. I mean, did you know that Prince was an epileptic? Never heard about that, but as a young person, Prince was epileptic. And also, Prince did not do drugs, and he did not drink, because he wanted to make certain that that was never a part of his message, and that was going to be his demise, or he didn't want that because he saw other people, other friends who did that, and that was had a negative effect. So when you think about, when I think about Prince, I don't think about Prince as a person who maybe would limit himself, so limited in terms of, I would not do drugs, I would not drink alcohol, because of his music being so expansive and so, soulful, spiritual. But you don't have to do drugs and you don't have to drink to do that. But these are choices that people make. And those choices that they make are personal choices in order for them to be better. Not better than someone, but better for themselves so they can be better for others. Another thing I read about Prince was that Prince was not selfish when it came to his music. Prince played and sang other people's music. Once again, this is a generosity of heart. I can only hope that as I reflect on the lives of Prince, as I've had to do the last couple of days, learning about his death and reflecting on Jackie Robinson, someone, and Rachel, I must say Rachel Robinson, his wife, and reading about Jackie Robinson and his life and why he did what he did. He wasn't just the feats as a sportsman, athlete, but he was a wonderful man, and his wife was a wonderful wife, and they were great partners in terms of bringing about a change. It was then, after he integrated baseball, national baseball, that other people followed, and so many other things happened the year that Jackie Robinson integrated baseball. Other opportunities emerged after that. So anyway, just hope I can do better. Not better than anyone, just better. So thank you very much for listening to that, because that came from my solar plexus. All right, here, let me see, what have I got? I'm going to do I think maybe the next time. Well, I think I'm going to play this. I'm going to play this anyway, because I think it's really a good interview. That Stevie Wonder did on CBS This Morning. So let me turn this down first. I didn't mean to do that. Huh. Patiently waiting there.
Prince is being celebrated today both for his prolific solo work and for his many collaborations with other artists, including the iconic Stevie Wonder.
Darn it, I did that again. Patience, Eunice, you're on the air. Don't let people see this side of you.
Prince performed with a legendary singer back in 2010, and many other times. Prince spoke about Wonder's influence in a 1999 interview with Larry King.
But a lot of people knew about me because I used Stevie Wonder as an inspiration, whom I look up to a great deal, just for the way that he crafted music and his connection to the spirit. And back then I used him as a role model in trying to play all the instruments and be very self-contained and keep my vision clear. So word spread very quickly about what I could do.
We are so honored to be joined by Stevie Wonder. He's joining us in Los Angeles very early this morning. Stevie, thank you so much. We really appreciate this because we all know what Prince meant to you. We really appreciate you joining us this morning. I want to start with this. So many people say that Prince influenced them, but yet we just heard Prince say that you were the one that influenced him. What does that mean to you, and how are you remembering him today?
Well, first of all, I'm very happy to be here with you. And nothing's too early or too soon to just celebrate the greatness of a man that, you know, did so much for the music world as well as for the consciousness of caring about people, as did he. As far as him saying that I influenced him, I feel honored that he influenced me too.
How so?
I always wanted to play. I always wanted to play the guitar, and so I found this instrument about 3 years ago.
Wow.
And so I said, I'm going to have a similar kind of sound, you know, just based on me liking, you know, the guitar and just liking what it was to be another way of expressing musically. So I think that for him and myself and all of us that just love playing instruments and learning how to play various instruments, we're challenged because instruments are like various colors that a person that is a painter on the canvas will use various colors to create the essence of what they want to say. Mm-hmm. So this is what we do with instruments.
Stevie, Charlie Rose here. Talk about genius. You understand genius. You are genius. What was it about Prince's genius?
The marriage of his love for music, the marriage of his love for humankind, the marriage of his love for equality, the fact that he was not afraid. He did not ever allow his dreams to be put to sleep based on fear. And so, you know, when I cry, every tear is for all those various reasons. You know, songs are like the memories, and so I remember a few years ago going to his concert at the Forum on my birthday, and it was so exciting to be able to perform with him. I didn't know it was going to happen, but we got on stage and we jammed together, and we've done that a few times, as we talked about Paris. But most of all, I just loved his heart.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Look like I lost my signal here to my interview. Yep. Let's see. So much for technology. Oh, well, sorry about that. That was an excellent interview. It was a CBS interview with Stevie Wonder and his relationship with Prince. You can find that on YouTube if you want to finish, but I won't be able to go back to it and play it. I've got to move on to something else. So the something else is my underwriting announcement. Okay. Elliott Counseling Group has 30 counselors providing mental health services for individuals, families, couples, children, and groups. Evening and weekend appointments are often available immediately. Virtually all insurance, including state employee insurance, is accepted. There is also a self-pay sliding scale. You can contact Kevin Elliott or his staff at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That is ElliottCounselingGroup.com. counselinggroup.com or 217-398-9066. Okay, Reverend Irvin Williams. Restoration Urban Ministry. The executive director is with us today. So, tell us, what is Restoration Urban Ministries? I'm sure there are people that know what it is, but some people don't know. What exactly is Restoration Urban Ministries?
Well, good morning first, and I'm just glad to be here this morning, Eunice. So
thank you
for that. Well, Restoration's been around 23 years now here in this community. And the purpose is to reach out to those who are hurt, broken, poor, homeless, disenfranchised, and not simply to be able to aid them in temporarily, but to be able to hopefully cause change in their lives in such a way that they can go on, feel integrated, part of society, and be able to accomplish everything that they're supposed to accomplish. We do know and acknowledge that there are some temporary issues like hunger. So first time, before you can actually deal with someone about some of the other major issues, you got to deal with the most immediate ones. So we provide a food pantry there where we feed people clothing, furniture, all those are free. We have a 74-unit motel where people actually live for about 11 months. And while they're doing, they're going through classes, training, and counseling and a number of other things there to be able to help them during the course of those 11 months to make adjustments, to pick up new disciplines, to get a new look on life and be able to step out there and accomplish to reach their potential. So I guess in a nutshell, that's what it is. And so we probably run through several hundred people a year that actually come out there to live, and we run about 3,000 people that we feed a month. So we stay pretty busy there.
So 3,000 people you feed a month. So you feed people come in just to eat?
We do have a small eating arrangement there where we feed people at lunchtime. But most of this is packaged groceries.
Okay.
So they can come in twice a month and they can get groceries to take home.
So I've always been rather interested in you. Why you? Why this? 23 years now. Because 23 years ago, I remember, I don't know if it's been that long, but Restoration Urban Ministries, when I met you, was in a hotel, sort of like an abandoned kind of hotel kind of thing. And oftentimes it was, you were trying to raise money to keep it going, to do the repairs and remodeling that need to be done. And it seems to be doing so much better now, but what was your vision back then?
It hasn't what you really have now? Changed. It hasn't changed any. Because of growing up the oldest of 18, I know what poverty is, severe poverty. I understand what it's like to go hungry at night. I understand what it's like when you can look through the cracks in the wall, cold in the winter, hot in the summer. And so that alone, and the fact that I believe it's a mandate for Christians to do these things. It isn't just for some organization to pop up and do it, but it's mandated to all Christians. Mm. So what we're doing is exactly what we're supposed to be doing, nothing more.
That's a very concise and honest answer.
Yeah.
I mean, it is true. If you say you're Christian, then it seems like that's a mandate. I was listening to Larry Graham, or I'm trying to think, was it Larry Graham? I think it was Larry Graham when I was telling you about who's also a Jehovah's Witness. And he said it's a mandate to go door to door and proselytize, because it says in the Bible, go therefore and make disciples of all. And so we had to do that. I had to do that. It was mandate. It was like, oh, if you want to. It wasn't. It was a mandate. And there's a mandate, too. We're supposed to love one another as God loves us. That's a mandate. And it's so interesting when you think about how religion or that can make this connection to this higher power that no one sees, but they seem to speak for it, you know, about what it expects of us and what we should be doing. And God wants this and God wants that. That love is not the center of the mandate. You know, we can even pray over wars and all this other stuff that has, and slavery too was supported by a slave Bible that was interpreted to the enslaved person so that they would continue to be in bondage and to do whatever they wanted to do. So you take your mandate very seriously. So many of the things that you do that is done at Restoration Urban Ministry is about clothing the hungry, helping the sick, helping those who are feeling lost and abandoned, and housing, the same thing you would do if Jesus came, right?
Yes. There's a simple scripture that sums it up. In Matthew 25, Jesus said, and he lists all these things about feeding and giving a drink of water and visiting the sick and about those that are in prison. He simply says, when you've done this unto the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. Mm-mm-mm. And it isn't something that requires a whole lot of theology or anything. We understand it. We see it as the mandate because it's given as a kind of judgment there that says this was expected, because he goes on and says, when you did not do these things. Mm-hmm. So he expects us to do these. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not something out of the ordinary for us. It is what we are supposed to do. Different levels, different ways. Some can do more than others, but we're all supposed to be involved in reaching those who are hurting, those that are vulnerable. That is who we are. You mentioned something about love, but the scripture says in John, it says that God is love. Mm-hmm. So if God is love, there's nothing higher. So if there's nothing higher and I desire to get closer to God, then basically what I'm doing is getting closer to love, mm-hmm. which means that if I want to talk about what's the highest level a person could achieve, love.
Mm-hmm.
Just that simple.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's so true. And one of the things I was thinking about Jackie Robinson is something, a quote, is a long quote, but I don't have the book in front of me. But it's a book he wrote, his autobiography, about I haven't arrived yet. Is because until that happens, we haven't arrived. How do we say we have arrived at, you know, because we haven't arrived there. Love, period. Not all these excuses why we don't do it. That's it. So it sounds to me that's what Restoration Urban Ministry is about. It's about that is the ultimate goal. That is the goal. So we'll keep pressing forward until we do that. So tell me some of the programs that you do that help people to know this love that they are. Because if God is love, that means that's who you are. And you've just kind of really lost your way, not only lost your way by yourself, but you've had help.
Yeah.
By institutions and systems that have said, you know, you're not loving and God doesn't love you. And so therefore there is no love much for you. But how do you help people to recover, to discover this love that's there? What are some of the programs and things you do at your Restoration Urban Ministry?
Well, I think that's the answer. It's what you do, mm-hmm. not so much what you say.
Mm-hmm.
And by reaching out to people, we recognize they're hurting. Many of them has been beat down. So another organization like us comes along and we says, okay, we understand what you've been through. We want to try to be there for you. And of course, they're paranoid. They're afraid. All their guards are up. And it takes time for people to be able to watch, to observe you, to be able to determine whether you really care for them or not. So when they come in our program, they're there for 11 months. And the idea is that we know they're afraid. And then there's always that they could be a cult. All those little things that people bring there with them. But only thing that we can do is just keep right on loving them. Be there at the time of their greatest needs. Meet those important things that right there that they think about. When you're out there, you're looking for, you're thinking survival. I want to get my belly full. I simply want to be able to rest and not have to worry. Let my guards down for a minute. Don't have to be afraid that someone's going to do something to me, hurt me. I want to know that I'm going to be here for a while, that every day I don't have to think about where am I going to sleep at tonight. We try to take away that pressure, give them a chance and say, listen, for the next 11 months, your biggest priority is you. So what we're going to do is we want to guide you through this. We're going to provide the things you need, and we're going to work with these issues. I do a cognitive behavioral class. So part of that is to say, okay, you're first off, you're not an accident. You're here with the purpose behind it. Now, let's understand a little bit about what you've been through, what's going on in your life, and let's look at those things. So let's see if those things have been very healthy or not. So we start that process. Then we've got a number of other classes that we do there. Everything from parenting classes, financial classes. We even share with them at some point how to buy a home. Because most of them come, and one of the thoughts that never enter their mind is owning property. And so if we can paint a vision there for them, to, once they begin to feel better about who they are and about their abilities, there's two components to self-esteem. One is self-love, but the other one is self-efficacy. And this idea of being able to believe that you're capable of achieving something. They got 11 months to work on it. Then they're also in an environment where their next-door neighbor is also practicing the same things. So that when the conversation begins between two people, they're both going to be talking about something a little bit more constructive. They're going to talk about how they can allow healing to flow there, to maintain it. Not something you just go pick up once in a while, but an atmosphere of healing, of restoration. So, you know, we do this through all of our programs. One of the things that we tell people, we can't make you accept Jesus. That's not our job. Only thing we can do is make sure you bump into him. So everywhere you go, whether you're talking to the maintenance person, you're talking to the housekeeper, you're across the street talking to one of us, or you're talking to your case manager, I got a feeling you're going to bump into him. And if he is who the scripture says, you're going to bump into love. You're going to find there's someone genuinely caring about you. So now, again, you can come out of the shell, and now you can begin to touch those areas, those tender spots, and let's deal with them. Mm-hmm. Because you've got a reason and there's a purpose for your being here. Let's see if we can get to that so that when you go out, you're able now to influence other people in a positive way. And again, slow, very slow process. Some people get it, many get it, many don't. But what we found is that even the ones that don't get it, they come back after they leave and they try again. They go out and they find out, you know, maybe I missed something here. And so the doors are open, come back, let's regroup, and let's go back at it again. Because one thing that has to happen is you've got to make it. You can't jump off the earth. You're still going to be here. You're going to still have to deal with issues and problems. So let's get back to work again, because you have to make it.
So you also provide like employment training, how to do job, how to have a job, how to look for a job, how to keep a job. You help people who are recovering addicts. You help people who are homeless, who've had a lot in life just shifted and changed. And they all come there.
And somehow they find us, and that could be from a number of different states. Sometimes we may have about 10 or 11 states represented there. How they found us, we don't know. We've had people from Alaska. How they found us, I do not know. But we do get people all the time who looks at the internet, they find this, and then they go out and they start searching, and somehow they end up at Restoration. So we get groups coming there all the time too, to learn more about what it is that we do there. And again, we haven't figured it all out. And one of the reasons, we're not pros. We're not that professional group that is designed to be able to help poor people. What we are the poor people learning how to help ourselves. And that's critical. We appreciate all the help, and we need all the help we can. But the help so that we can stand on our own feet and not have someone have to continually to hold us up. So we paint visions. We want people to move beyond where they are and don't get to a certain place and stop. That's the reason why I said we even teach home ownership, because we want them to keep moving forward. We want them to realize it. We talk to people about things like, some of you need to even think about politics. Why aren't some of our people running down there trying to get on city council? We need to always be sitting in those meetings. We need to take an active role. So we start with where they are, and then we try to hopefully, as time goes on, to build and give them an opportunity where their eyes are open till there's more than just the little four walls they're in, and that there is no limits to what they can do and what they can accomplish, and their voice is important.
It's very important.
Yes.
What about the, so So you were talking about home ownership. I was reading that you have a program now that's starting too about mini homes.
Yeah.
And these homes are, okay, so tell us about that.
Well, again, my goal is that what's the next step?
Okay.
The next step isn't even, you leave restoration. Hopefully you got a plan at this point, because really, if you're leaving, you've crossed my desk. You've been in and you've had the private as well as the working with our case managers. So where we go from here? So they actually line up and work out a plan that's supposed to take them for the next 10 to 20 years, the long range. They also have short-term goals. But part of that, too, is, so what do you do tomorrow and then the next day? And where is this going to go? The things that you do today is to build on what your tomorrows are going to look like. And one day, to move beyond just simply renting a place is part of it. We have a lot of people out there, good, hardworking people. They are. They've given it everything they got. It's not their fault that they didn't get the education that they need. It's not their fault that they don't have all the skills, nor the fact that they don't have a very professional job. Mm-hmm. Some of them, they wait tables, but they have faithfully waited those tables year after year after year. They pay their rent. They pay their utilities. They take care of their children. Some work in two jobs like that. And they've taken care, do what they can, and they pay the high rent that this community has. What we offer is, for some of those starting out, is our mini home. We don't give it because we don't have the money to give them away. Mm-hmm. But we raise the money, build the house, put a family in it. And these are usually families that's proven already that they can't go down to the bank and get a loan. There's other places they can't get from any other lending institution. But we'll carry the note, and now you own it. You've got the keys. You've got the paper in your hands. Continue what you've been doing. And if you do, the end result is that you actually have something with your name, a title deed. Mm. That's the goal there, to reward those who try so hard.
That's right.
To do it, and yet they're not rewarded with the American dream.
And these homes are equivalent, I think I read, $27,000?
That's what we've got tied up so far. The average cost is probably about
$30,000. And the size of these mini homes?
They're small. We're talking about 500 square feet.
Okay.
Actually, it's about 480 to 500, depending, again, on the homes. They're designed in such a way that you can actually add a module onto it, where you can put once you pay that off, if you want to, rather than move, you can add these other components to it.
Mm.
They're designed also so that you can take the roof off if you need to, and you can go up with it as well.
Mm.
So as they grow, the family grow, they can grow the house too.
So what about the land? Is land part of the mini home? So once you, the $30,000 includes the land that the home is built on?
So far.
Okay.
Because what we're using is donated property.
Wow.
We get some property from the city. These are odd size shaped lots, and the city really can't do anything with them. Other people can't do very much, but it's just enough to put a nice home and a car there and a little bit of expansion room on it.
Wow. Now, this idea of mini homes, because I've seen what they call little houses, tiny houses on television. When did this idea emerge in terms of restoration or urban ministry? Who was involved in this mini home idea?
Well, we've been working on this here for the last few years. The idea of restoration has been around since about 94, 95.
Mm-hmm.
We just couldn't afford it. We couldn't do anything with it. We would meet, we would talk about it and put it back on the shelf. And here in the last couple of years, suddenly it seemed possible. Actually, just a little bit longer than that, because this first home, it was our little church group that raised the money to build this. And we're talking about people who got very little and they put very little, but we were able to cut aside each year enough that went into this little account so that we'd have the money to build this first home. We believe that if a group small and with the kind of funds that we bring in, if those folks can come together and build a home, I'm quite sure some of our larger churches doing so much better can do the same. Our groups. So we're encouraging groups and people also too, to look at it. It's real. It's possible. Mm-hmm. You can do this thing here. Mm-hmm. And if it takes a number of us coming together to be able to play someone that's worthy inside of one of these homes, let's do it. Let's mm-hmm. go for it.
Let's go for it. I think that's wonderful. So you've already built a home.
Building.
You're building a home now. So, and this is, so where is this home going to be built? Do we know?
Yeah, it's actually the building, the shell, everything is up now. We're doing a little bit of work on the ceiling, and then we start the rough on the roof, and then we start the roughing in mm-hmm. on the interior.
Now, are these like module homes? Are these sort
nope.
of
no nope? stick built?
Wow!
We pour the foundation, and with the help of volunteers and people in the community, mm-hmm. we come together and we erect that home.
And this has nothing to do with Habitat for Humanity.
No.
This is totally on its. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be. It could be individual churches deciding this is what they're going to do. Yeah, because if Bernie, I think he was on a, I saw on a Bernie, the running for office, mm-hmm. and he, his biggest donation sometimes were $2.37. That's what he was asking for. And he was able to raise millions.
Yeah.
So we know that if we all contributed what we could, you know, and that's the vision, then why wouldn't it be?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's very possible. So some of the other things that you're doing at Restoration, which is a continual thing, you're doing some remodeling too?
Yes.
Building. So tell us about that.
Well, right now, we're a lot of people are graduating, finishing up, and moving on. As we empty out one of these buildings here, last year we took our larger building, 44 units, and we went in, did the same thing. We went in and remodeled the unit. We had people from the community came, and we had a work week, and it took us about 10 days to go. I mean, stripped it bare, carpet and repair and painting, everything that needed to be done to that room, electrical, plumbing work, so that when this new fall group come in, they actually stepped into a new room. And even though the building looked the same on the outside, the rooms were all new. And we're getting ready to do it the second time again with 32 more rooms, where we'll strip them down in July, and we'll go in, groups will come in, help us, and we'll place everything will be new inside the room. And so when the fall group begins to come in, they actually come into a new room. Mm. And that's got something to do with how people feel about themselves, too.
Right, right, right. Because you're not just putting them into dilapidated, placing, you know, you don't have better than this, so you have anything to complain about. I have read where people actually for where they provide food for people who need food, they don't serve it to them in a, you know, way like we're just slopping it on your plate.
Yeah.
They actually give them napkins, cloth napkins, a menu, etc., and they treat them with kindness. And I think it makes a difference when we're not condescending to one another, when we actually are reaching across the table and we're helping each other. Because when we're reaching like that, we're actually reaching to help ourselves. It's like we have to do it.
Yeah.
It's a mandate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I believe, too, you deserve that.
Mm-hmm.
Just the idea of being birthed mm-hmm. alone,
mm-hmm.
that the fight for life,
mm-hmm.
you made it.
Mm-hmm.
You made it through that.
Mm-hmm.
And every day you wake up, you make it through one more day.
Mm-hmm.
And you really deserve someone to have some level of respect and honor and someone to esteem you and make you feel good about who you are.
Mm-hmm.
You've been through something.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we try to, we pray that we do. And so it's important to give people that sense of respect.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
There's
I keep thinking about a scene too. When I was listening to this interview of Rachel Robinson about her husband, Jackie Robinson, and she said there was a scene where, you know, because most of his teammates were white. And I think Capanella became one, and I'm trying to think the other person. So it was like maybe two other ones at some point. But the media and highlighted the fact that his teammates didn't want him there. You know, pretty much that was the thing. We don't really want you here. But also, with his teammates being white, if they showed him any kind of support or encouragement, it was more referred to as like they're condescending. you know, like I'm being nice to him, you know, because he's black and he's the only one here, da da da. And she said there was a photo that people like to look at, and that's the one where, I think his name was Pee-wee, is one of his, you remember this yeah. one? Where he has his arm around Jackie Robinson, this white player, teammate who was Southern, but also, you know, he's had his arm around Jackie. She says, that's not my favorite photo. She said, my favorite photo is when they're running off the field and they both do that. They're both reaching towards each other to kind of touch fists because it was a mutual relationship. He was not helping Jackie. And I think so often we get that photo, that picture, that we oppress people, but then when we help them from what we're oppressing them in doing, oppressing them, we're actually further impressing, putting that oppressive experience there, you know? What you're talking about and what I'm saying is totally different. And what Jackie's widow was saying, Rachel, is that you're not helping me like you're reaching down and pulling up something that is, you know, worth nothing. You're actually seeing me for who I am. And that means more. And I think one of the reasons why we keep seeing the same thing repeated over and over again, no matter how much help we seem to be giving people, quote, giving people, is that attitude that's there too, which is, I don't want to be like that anymore, and I don't ever want to identify with those people that are like that. I want to remove myself from that idea of who I am, and I'm not that.
Yeah.
And that's communicated too.
Yeah.
And so that love or that generosity of I have something to share and you have something to share and we have something to give because we do. We're born with that. That when we acknowledge that, it goes much further than if we put a whole bunch of money into something and then, you know, say, oh, see, I put all that money in there, but it didn't go nowhere.
Yeah.
It's because that spirit is not shared among everybody. And that is, we're all part of this life circle, you know, and we all have something to contribute. So I really appreciate what you do. So volunteers and money. So how do people know about these buildings, these redevelopment plans you have, and how do people donate to Restoration Urban Ministry? How do they get involved in Restoration Urban Ministry? It's such a, to me, it's quiet. It's like...
Yeah.
You know, it's like a, you know, it's never blaring out at you, and yet it just keeps going, doing better and better.
Yeah.
So how do people participate in these supporting? How do they do that? How do they learn more about it?
Well, our doors are always open. We encourage people all the time to come down, find out what we do. I can tell you anything. I can tell you we do this, we do that. I can really spin out a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the best way for you to know is when you make that visit, when you come and you sense the atmosphere and you see what's going on. You see people working and doing things. You see people helping others. You see people coming in, getting food and leaving. You see people coming across the street, going to classes, going back home. You see people working with other folks, and it's busy around there. And I think when you do that, that's one of the best ways to know whether you're in the right place or not. Of course, our newsletter. We've got some things now, I think, that's on the internet. We've got, of course, our webpage, restorationurbanministries.net. We have something on YouTube all the time.
You have something on YouTube? What's on YouTube?
They basically run our sermons
okay.
and things. They do all that.
Mm-hmm.
And we also, they do it also on the local.
UP?
Yeah. UP, yeah.
Mm-hmm, I know.
Yeah, okay. They do something there, too.
Yeah, I don't have access to that channel.
Well, I don't do it. We mm-hmm. got people that
But
do
I don't
that.
Have access to the channel
yeah.
with what I have in my home.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Mm-hmm. So we do that. And then the biggest one, though, is word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that if we're doing what we're supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
then we don't have to get up and light a fire and get everybody looking this way. Just do what we do. and we try to reach where we can reach. But the most important thing is spend our energy into people. Mm-hmm. That's the important part. It's not the ones that people identify with. It's that little simple person who has been pushing a basket. That little person that says, I've been sleeping on the sofa with my family for the last 2 years with my kids, and I just need a chance. Mm-hmm. You know, and people may not recognize them, and somehow they find their way to us. Those are the ones who hear. Those are the ones that respond, and those are the ones we're after. Yes, we need to do better at marketing. I'm terrible at marketing. But it's about making sure that we spend our time reaching those people that need us. Mm-hmm. And we've got a couple of other projects that has really, and in fact, I'm so excited. The mini home is just one of them. But we also got our first contract with the city about 2 weeks ago. Mm. We formed an organization. Part of what we do is that we take guys, men and women, we do some training. And then what we do is we've been bidding on demolition projects. So we finally won our first two homes here a couple of weeks ago. What does that mean? That just simply means we're going out, our group, our organization, we're tearing down homes like any other professional demolition group would do. And we're collecting, we bid on the job and we collect a check for it. That means these guys are not just simply working, but they're getting top dollar. We're talking about $30, $32 an hour. Most of them would never get an opportunity to earn that kind of money. So they get a chance to go to work, and now they got some money to spend. When the city started this whole project with tearing down the homes over here, we wanted to get involved. We approached the city. Because we wanted to say, listen, you can bring in a major contractor, mow it all down, and move on. But the idea is that that money needs to flow back in the community. That's going to help the economy more than anything else. So they devised this program where they broke it up in small increments and gave groups like us an opportunity to come in, bid, go in, tear it down, and put people to work and get that money circulating within the community. Mm-hmm. I'm so excited about that.
Yeah, I am too.
And I'm believing that we're going to get more. Are we getting better at the bidding process? Mm-hmm. So we're going to get more and more of those homes. Our guys are going to work, and they have a chance to be able to push their chest out, feel good about themselves because they did the work, and they can stand alongside anyone else. Mm-hmm. Stokely Carmichael said something years ago. He said one of the problems that we made during this whole movement during the 60s, he said, was that we thought we had to go to another race to get our freedom.
Oh, my goodness.
And instead of recognize that it's God-given. Mm-hmm. So I stand equal alongside anyone and everyone else. I don't have to go to that person or feel lower than them. Mm-hmm. And I don't want people condescending or feeling like you're helping me. Mm-hmm. No, we stand together as partners to do this thing here. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to do something, then acknowledge me as your equal. Mm-hmm. And give me the opportunity to get out of the way.
Just get out of the way.
Give me the opportunity mm-hmm. to show what I'm capable of doing. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you know. If mm-hmm. you want to help me, then teach me that. Mm-hmm. But when it comes down to freedom and equality, you can't give me that. It's already mine. Mm-hmm. So why would I go to you to get that?
Oh, my goodness.
So, and so we're saying, listen, mm-hmm. you know, you just don't have the training, mm-hmm. but you're as capable as anyone else. And if you apply yourself, and you may have to do a whole lot more mm-hmm. because there are some that want to hold on to this. Mm-hmm. And we're going to say, not any longer, mm-hmm. you know, because we have the right mm-hmm. to be able to seek out our destiny and to achieve and become, whether you're black or white, red, yellow, brown. Mm-hmm. That applies to us poor. Mm-hmm. It applies to all of us. Mm-hmm. We have that. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't have to feel like I'm lower than someone else. Mm-hmm.
You have spoken so much. I think about the relationship that Branch Ritchie and Jackie Robinson had, the manager who actually approached Jackie Robinson. It was when he was in college, and he was a coach. And I don't know if he was still in college, but he was a coach. And on this team was one black player, and I forgot his name was Thomas something or whatever. But anyway, when they were going out to Indiana to play a game, He couldn't stay in a hotel with the rest of the players. And they said, we don't allow. So he says, well, just let him be in my room. And so that was done. But the player was scratching his hands saying, why am I this color? Why do I have to be this color? And he said that he kept that image in his mind. And when it was always part, he was a Methodist and he was a Christian. And it was always part in his mind that he was going to be instrumental in changing baseball and integrating baseball. And that relationship, Rachel Robinson says in her interview, was a partnership. It was never, this is what you do, Jackie. It was an agreement. It wasn't a partnership. It was, we're going to do this together. And another thing I wanted to just mention, too, is something else I was thinking about, how you're talking about this idea of waiting for someone to acknowledge you, to say you therefore exist because I finally see you. I was speaking to someone and they were saying that Harriet Tubman would be on the $20 bill.
Yes.
But he said it's going to be another 15, 20 years or whatever before. And, you know, we still waiting. So my son's, we're not waiting for Harriet Tubman to be on that $20 bill. You know, we're not waiting. And that idea that I'm waiting for someone to give me my due, for someone to say, you exist, I am here. I'm not needing that image, that mirror. You are not an adequate reflection of who I am. And so I really appreciate what you said because it's so true. And I see construction workers. I see them out here and I look to see, where are these black men out there? Where are these black people out there?
Yes.
There's no reason why they can't do some of this work here,
mm-hmm.
you know? But I know people say, oh, you got to know somebody to know somebody. And that is terrible. That is terrible.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta have an in. I was looking at, and I'm gonna stop talking for a second. I was looking at, because things just kind of run together for me. And I was looking in the newspaper, and in the newspaper about the coach's son, there's someone who is playing for, you know, is a coach for U of I. And I don't know if it's which team it is, but then it says the son is now working for, you know, the U of I. You know, this what is called nepotism.
Nepotism, yes.
It exists. And we say, oh, it exists in this particular area. No, it doesn't. It exists so that we only help those we want to help, that help to solidify our identity, that make us feel good. So I like what you say. I really appreciate what you say because it is so true. And if you see yourself, if I see myself doing that, I have to ask myself, am I really doing the best I can do when I only want to narrowly define my window of who I'm going to support or who I'm going to care about? When it becomes that narrow for me, when it just, you know, it's just about my kids, it's just about my family, it's just about my this, my that. When I keep seeing that, I want to do better.
Yeah.
I want to do better. And it's better when we do it that way. And I'll tell you a secret. I'll tell you a secret, but another time. It's not really a secret, but it's just it's how you are in these systems and you are educated in these systems. You work within these systems. You go to school in these systems. You labor in these systems. And you become like the system.
Yes.
And I think it's so important that this attitude is addressed. Yes. We're part of the problem. We're part of this problem. It just keeps perpetuating itself.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not like you.
Yeah.
I'm not you. And I'm so thankful, but I want to help you, but I'm not you. And that attitude is communicated. And so when they get to do better, they say, I ain't going to be like you either and them people, but I'll help you. But we're also communicating this kind of loathing, self-loathing we have for one another.
Yeah. I could be wrong, but
nope.
I believe that we have been conditioned
mm-hmm.
not to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got this image in our head about where we are, and it's false. It's not true. My eyes opened. I've shared this with you before. When I went to Africa,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't realize, like you said, been educated. My whole life has been built around these systems here. So I get off the plane in Africa, And within moments, I'm overwhelmed because now what I see is not minorities where occasionally you'll spot one of them. But everywhere I look, there's all these black people. And I'm so used to seeing white. I want it white. I long for white people. And I didn't realize it was there until I got there. And I was uncomfortable because now I saw black leaders and black people doing this and owning and running and managing and operating. And they weren't the minority. And so, it worked on my head for days. I've made many a trips. Taken many of people over there since then. Mm-hmm. And many of people have had that moment when they were overwhelmed because they were not used to seeing their own people out there. And so we perpetuate that institution. We keep it going because it's the only thing we know. It's what we see. And even when we think we're enlightened and we see it, we still practice it and we can't see it. And now we've got other people. It's not just the fault of a group of people. It's all of it. It's institutionalized. We think it's supposed to look like that. And when it doesn't look like that, the picture is crooked. Mm-hmm. And when that's the way it's supposed to look like where you see us, I'm supposed to ride downtown and see black people out there working on the streets and doing holding those jobs. I'm supposed to see black principals and black doctors and black politicians. I'm supposed to see those things. The picture is not crooked. That's when the picture finally gets straight. When I'm noticed, I'm seen. And that means black people got to change the way how they see themselves and white people got to change the way how they see us so that those things come together because we've all been conditioned not to see.
Exactly. Ooh-wee, I tell you something else. Ooh-wee. Yes, you're speaking the truth. It's so true and it's so honest what you said because I saw myself doing that very thing. I don't know if I ever told you, but it was this. I was traveling to Chicago and it was when Harold Washington was the mayor of Chicago. But I'm going to my mom's house and my mom's lived in this house for over 30 something years, right? But as you drive and you notice the streets eroding and the infrastructure's tearing down, the viaducts are crumbling and its basketball nets aren't being replaced and stuff. And over time, it just begins to look just dilapidated. It's just looking terrible. My mother's keeping her house neat. She's changed, fixing the roof. She's taking care of her property. But the streets, this dirt, this trash, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to Chicago and I'm noticing as I'm going to my driving to my mother's house, these streets are being fixed that have not been fixed for years. This viaduct that's been crumbling is fixed. This basketball court that's been looking neglected and ignored and not even a basketball court. The nets are there. There's a new court, the new street lights. And I'm going to my mother's house and I make this statement to someone and I say, wow. Look, I'm noticing all these changes in these. He said, because your tax dollars are now going into your community.
Yes.
So all this time I'm thinking in my hood and where I'm living, how many black people? I thought I was okay with that, but I'm counting how many black people in my neighborhood. And I'm going to my mother's house and I'm noticing this attitude. I don't recognize this attitude in me. I wasn't raised with this attitude in me, but there it is because you've been around it. This attitude is making inroads into you. And so he says to me, your tax dollars are being steered, have been steered out of your community. So therefore you don't see the repairs. You don't get those street cleaning. You don't get that. Mayor Daley's he lived in a Bridgeport, which was predominantly labor, just labor, blue collar workers, right? But you didn't see that. The streets were clean. There were holes and da, da, da. That's because the money was going there. So if you paint a picture that wherever you go, we destroy, we tear it up. We don't take care of it. No matter how you work hard, no matter how you struggle, like that person who says, I can't ever get a house, but these are real systems put in place to give you that image of what it is that your efforts are amounting to. And when you look around that, you look at yourself And that's the thing, is that it's not about looking at other people. It really isn't. It's never been about looking, because these experiences we're having, I believe they're there for all of us. And it's all of us need to ask ourselves, what am I experiencing? And how am I understanding my experience? And who is now, what am I doing with that? I have to be observant and aware at all times. That awareness has to be part of our education. That awareness has to be part of everything that we do. It is not enough to say, here, we gonna do this. But why and how and for what is the purpose of what we're doing? If we don't examine ourselves, it doesn't go very far. And that's why I think that idea of understanding the self, it has to go around and circulate several thousand times within yourself and say, how am I living? How am I doing? And I do believe it makes all the sense in the world, because that experience, along with other experiences, was for me to see, not myself, but to see how I began to see how I was looking at people and how I wanted to protect my little bit of pie. And that's all it was a little bit. And I realized that attitude exists. We want to be separate and apart from everything. And when this experience is for all of us, it really is to edify and to enrich and to help us to understand and appreciate each other better. And without that, we don't get it. And unless I get it, I don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, I got to get it. And then I got to not tell anybody about it. It says, show them, be that. Be the change you want to see in the world. So that's wonderful. I have to ask you a question about this soap thing, and you got to go because I don't want you to be late for your appointment. But you got soap. Also, you are going to be selling, they're selling soap now at Restoration Urban Ministry. Yeah. So now you're going into the retail business.
Yeah.
So tell us more about the soap.
It wasn't my idea.
Okay.
It came from the U of I.
Okay.
And in one of our classes, we have some U of I students there that teach a class for us, a group called Enactus.
Enactus?
So, Enactus.
Enactus, okay.
Right. So one of the projects they had approached me at some point was, what if we could come up with something that our group, our class, could actually make, produce, and sell? And the idea of the soap came up. So what we did was we gave some extra time for the class. So they taught them how to make the soap and everything. And then they actually took it to Mother's Day on campus here a couple weeks ago, and they sold out. And, of course, we got a news article came out regarding what we were doing and what they were doing. And from here on out, including today, they're at the farmer's market. And they'll be selling these bars of soap, which they make in the class. It really isn't about the soap, though, you know. It helps to raise a little bit of money, but it's about them and who they believe they are and what they're capable of achieving. Here's something totally new, totally different for them. And says, okay, well, I don't know if that's what I want to do. Let's try this. Let's try it. See if you can master it. And then let's move on to something else from there. So it gives them that place to where they can actually create something and then take it, market it, and to the community.
Well, I'm going to look for it. I'm going to Farmer's Market. I'm going to look for it's Restoration Urban Ministries.
Yeah.
Awesome. And it's made out of coffee grains or what?
The coffee grains is because the coffee is a natural
exfoliant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it, and then it's what they, these are, it's like, if you think about all the soap that's wasted.
Oh, we throw these little pieces of soap.
Yes. And especially at motels and hotels.
Oh, yeah.
So we gather that up. They melt it down. There's some other things they do to it. Add the coffee grounds to it. Shape it, mold it, box, package it, and then sort of recycle it.
Exactly, because we just waste it anyway, you know. And actually, everything is recycled, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really, everything is about life itself being renewed again and again and again. We didn't create it. We didn't make it, but we just appreciating it.
Yeah.
Wow. Did you get to talk about everything?
That's enough. I'll come back again, though, but that's enough.
All and right.
We got so many things that are going on. To me, exciting things.
So did we talk about exciting things? What about the other exciting thing? Come on.
But you know, we open up three other branches. We have one local, but we also have two in Oklahoma.
A Restoration Urban Ministry.
Right.
Okay.
And under different names.
Oh.
But under the organization.
Okay.
And we also, too, we're connected with, of course, our Nigerian group. And we're going to have about a delegation of those coming this summer, where they're going to spend about a week training and learning there with us. We're going to have a conference so that we can bring in our other groups, and we're all going to meet together, and we're going to, a lot of it's going to be for educational purposes. And
when is this going to be?
Excited. This will be in July, actually.
And are you going to be on higher ground so that I get to promote this or talk about it or
That's
whatever?
Fine. That's fine.
So do I have to get in contact with you to set up a time? Because I know you're going to be busy around
yes.
that. So I'm going to have to, a couple weeks maybe before then?
That's fine with me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, sounds exciting.
Yeah. So, and of course, the other big thing is that right now, that's where I'm going in a few minutes, is that we have Saturday classes. And so we've got about a dozen people in there that we're prepping and getting them ready to continue to expand this thing out a little bit further.
Expand what thing out?
The ministry work.
Oh, okay.
And some of those things. And
okay.
They become actively involved mm-hmm. as ministers within mm-hmm. the group. And then what's happened is that several of our people came out, and that's why these other branches have opened up.
Okay. I think I remember the last time I spoke with you, you were telling me about this one in Oklahoma. And I think these are people that were formerly residents of some of them?
Yeah, I don't know if any of our current ones right now were residents, but they were part of the organization.
Right, right.
And so they've gone on to open up their church and mm-hmm. ministry work, and they've got things going on there now.
Wow. What's that like having all these children? You know, children have been, you know, coming through, like a teacher who has, you know, taught class and looking at people who have touched Restoration Urban Ministry has touched their lives in such a profound way. How does that feel? Humbling?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. I'm known as 18 brothers and sisters, so it's almost natural.
18 brothers and sisters.
So
that
it's kind of natural.
That is just way out. That's a way out number to me.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't get everything out, but it's an exciting time. So if you want to know more about Restoration Urban Ministries, I would encourage you to go to Restoration Urban Ministries website, right?
Right.
And also, you can also visit Restoration. When is the best time for people to come by and just visit? Just
anytime.
Look at it. So anytime.
Yeah.
1213 Parkland Court.
Yes. The doors are open for the public from 10 o'clock to 5 o'clock.
And also, donations are also appreciated. So if you get the newsletter, you'll see that there's always residential needs. Specific needs, and then organizational needs, things that are useful to keeping the place developed. Used to have other things like bricks and things like that you used to ask for, I think, on there, your needs. Was it bricks or building tools? I don't see that.
Building tools.
You don't have that on here anymore.
It changes. You know, and sometimes, and the community's been really good about supporting us with needs. So there's always new needs. It's always changing.
People have to see that, and it's because the work that is being done. And I'm sure there are businesses and organizations that U of I, I saw in the newsletter, you have U of I students and classes and that's going on, so that you're team working with other people and other organizations in order for Restoration Urban Ministry to reach as many people as necessary and to truly support people in doing the best they can. So I appreciate you so much, Doctor. I mean, I want to call you Doctor, but I don't want to call you Doctor. I want to call you Reverend. I don't want to call you Reverend. I want to call you Irvin, but I'll call you Reverend Irvin Williams. I just want to call you Sweetheart. I want to call you Love, because you are. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, yeah. You're so welcome. So come back again, and I will be in touch with you I can do that when you have that conference thing, you know? Okay.
Will do.
All righty. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. So anyway, we're going to keep going. And thank you. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And we're going to keep going. This is WEFT Champaign 90.1, streaming online at weft.org. And I've got to get this queued up right away because I want you to hear some of this interview that Ruby Dee does. Wasn't that a wonderful, wonderful time with Reverend Irvin Williams? It's always such an inspiration for me when I invite him to be on Higher Ground, because he's doing such good work. I mean, Restoration Urban Ministry is just doing fabulous work. And so many people are doing fabulous things. One of the benefits of being a member of WEF is that you can take our air shifter training for free. A new session is coming up, so take this opportunity to get on the air at WEFT. Classroom training will be held on May 3rd and 4th, and in addition, you will have two studio sessions scheduled. Pick up an application here at the station, 113 North Market Street, on our website at weft.org, or email airshiftertraining@weft.org. For more information, call Vicki at 217-778-1664. Okay, so I'm looking for, bear with me. I'm not going to try to do too many things at once. Because I just seem to mess up. So I'm just going to take my time and I'm going to find what I said I was going to find. And what's going on today? I guess I could put some music on, except I don't have any music. I guess I could play Prince again. I was reading in a newspaper today that, what city is that? What state? It pardoned former felons so that they can now vote, and it was like, what, 200,000 or something? It's an amazing number of people who have paid their, what is it, their whatever, served their time, and they can vote, and which predominantly black men. So you know what that means, right? Black folks can't vote. So that means you get to sway who you want to be in office. There was a YouTube video, was it YouTube? But it was a one about, I saw recently about the 25 infantry bicyclists, people of color. And this was doing in the late 1890s or early 1900s. It's bicycle infantry. I think you'd look that up. You would find that quite interesting to see. Let me see here. What am I looking for? Rachel Robinson. Robinson. I'm going to play this for as long as I can. And then you get to finish it. As soon as I find it, I'll let you know which one. Oh, yes. It's called Lachaim, L-C-H-A-Y-I-M, Rachel Robinson, Jackie Robinson's widow. It's an interview. And it's about an hour long. I'm going to play this one. Yes, this is about an hour long. And I, you can listen to it for as long as you can. And then, it'll just fade out. Jackie Robinson's wife.
When we were growing up, we were inferior, and that we were lazy, not seeking.
Rachel, if I had known you in the 30s and the 40s, when you were growing up, what was your perception of America as a whole, in terms of how the world treated the African American?
When we were growing up, we were, what they was conveyed to us is that we were inferior, and that we were lazy, not seeking a better life, discrimination was rampant then, and very open. When we were kids, we went to the neighborhood theater, and they would direct us to the balcony. We didn't even understand why we were directed to balcony until we got a little older, but that was the nature of segregation. So it was very rampant in my childhood times.
Did you feel it?
I felt it, but you know, my father and mother had been so specific about who we were, what we could do, the positive aspects of our culture, that I had a way to fight off those impressions that people had. Mm-hmm. I didn't take them into me. I didn't say, oh, I'm inferior, so I should hide behind something. Mm-hmm. Or I shouldn't aspire to be anything special. Mm-hmm. My father said, you're going to college, and I'm going to help you get there.
He did say that.
Absolutely. He raised my first tuition at UCLA from his buddies in the Veterans Corps.
Wow. And why nursing, Rachel?
Why nursing? Oh, my mother was, we had a wonderful family doctor. And our whole family depended on him, and he took care of all of us. He was extraordinary. Between his influence and my mother's influence, who my mother worshipped the medical field and nursing field, so I knew that's where I was going, because I was trying to please them. Initially, I was trying to please them, and when I got into it, I felt like it's right for me. This is where I belong.
I want to quote from your book, and for people who may not know the story, and you'll tell me if I get it basically right. Jackie Robinson goes to UCLA. He's a four-letter man. The war starts. By the way, it's interesting. He is playing for a minor league, Negro team, and they're visiting Hawaii. And he's in Hawaii on December 5th, 1941. He leaves on December 5th. And, of course, on December 7th, 1941, we have Pearl Harbor.
Right.
He then he enlists in the Army with some friends. He serves in the Army. You know, if we had all the time in the world, we'd talk about his interesting experiences in the Army. He comes out of the Army, and he's going to play ball. And ultimately, he plays first for the Kansas City Monarchs, which is a great team from the Negro League with Satchel Paige, etc.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, as I described, he is signed by the Brooklyn Dodger organization, and he is going to go with you to your first spring training in Daytona, Florida, to play for the Montreal Royals, their minor league baseball team. You write about what it's like heading with your husband to Daytona for the first spring training, and this is what you write: that you had an unguarded faith in being American, although I did have, you write, some trepidation about entering the South for the first time. And when I read it, I said to myself, isn't that interesting? You're really a California girl, mm-hmm, who knows what the South is, although you've never experienced it. When you write about being, you have unguarded faith in America, it's such an interesting phrase. Rachel, what do you mean, an unguarded faith in America as a 22, 23, 24, 25-year-old girl?
Being unguarded means I was open to the values and the strengths of the American society. And so I was kind of protected by that, I thought. And so going south, I knew there were going to be attacks on us and attacks on our race, on our feelings, on our movements. But I didn't want it to change the way I dealt with things. I knew I could manage it because I felt I'm an American and I have rights and I am a good person. And so it was startling to me, though, when I got to Daytona, when we were bumped from two planes before we got there.
It was worse than you had anticipated.
Much worse than I thought it would be. More blatant, you know, the attacks on us in terms of are just being taken off of two airplanes and told to wait. And we were trying to get to spring training on time, and so it was very tense and very urgent for me. The only way one little way that I tried to deal with it is I walked into the white lady's bathroom.
Yes, you did.
And I held my head up and I went in there, did my business, and looked at the ladies and walked out. And I felt better. I felt, respect for myself and restored. My confidence was restored.
In L.A., were there white and black segregated restrooms?
No.
So this was your first experience.
This was the first experience with segregation.
Yes.
With signs on the water fountains, signs on the restroom, not being able to eat in the restaurant in the airport. So Jack and I decided we wouldn't eat. If they wanted us to come to the back door and take sandwiches out, we wouldn't do it. And the funny part was that Mally, Jack's mother, having all these experiences in the South, had given us a box of fried chicken before we got onto the plane. And we were a little embarrassed because we thought the chicken smelled, and Mally didn't know, we were going to be fed on the plane. And we ate every bit of that fried chicken.
It turned out in the end you needed it.
And we needed it.
Yes.
And we needed it.
Yes. You write very movingly about that. You write about one other event that I want you to recall from me. You're on the way to spring training and American Airlines bumps you, and they bump you again, and in the end you have to take a bus.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take the bus, you and Jack get on the bus. It's pretty empty at the time. You sit up front. Jack falls asleep. The bus fills up. And the bus driver then wakes him, or tells you to wake him, and says, you must now move to the back of the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I know there are many people watching who do not understand the history of Jackie Robinson. But one of the things that was true about him was he had a passion for the rights of his people. And he had a temper, and he could express himself. And very often, he took on the establishment when he felt, as you felt, you were going to go into that white bathroom,
mm-hmm.
even though it said whites only. And he was known for standing up for himself and his people. And you write, however, that on this bus trip, when he's awakened, there's a moment when you wonder whether he's going to make a scene. And instead, he takes you to the back of the bus, where there are other Negroes waiting, and you spend the rest of the trip with that. And you write that you weep silently because you felt at that moment something had been taken from your husband. Now, it turned out, by the way, nothing was taken from him. But I want you to try to remember what that moment was like for you and how you place it. In other words, if I had met you that day, what did it tell you about America? What did it tell you about the experience you were about to enter?
Jack was court-martialed in the Army for refusing to go to the back of a bus. So he'd had that experience. So when this driver came up to us and said we had to move to the back of the bus when we were on the streets, I was afraid that Jack might respond in some angry way and get us into trouble. And the goal was to get to spring training. The goal was not to let anything interfere with that. So, and he understood that, and he just kind of agreed and walked to the back. And then I started to cry because I felt they had reduced the man to a boy. And that was the attempt in segregated situations, is to take away your strengths, your confidence, your belief in yourself. And I felt they had done that to him when he was so complacent about going to the back of the bus.
Did you talk to him about it?
No. I was very protective of him. And I didn't want him to see me suffering or feel that I was suffering, because we had a lot of challenges ahead of us.
Ultimately, he goes to Montreal. He is a huge success in Montreal, has a great first game, ultimately helps the team win the league, the little World Series, whatever it was called. And you, for the first time, it seems, become aware of what his playing baseball might mean on a larger level, and that what you wrote was, we were beginning to understand this was more than just a job opportunity. And that, you know, this is so real, Rachel. For in retrospect, there's history being made. At the time, you're a young, newly married wife. You're going to have a child the following year. Jack has to earn a living. And playing baseball was his livelihood. And so in some way, I could understand both of you seeing this as a job. But at the same time, you write that you begin to understand that there's something more going on here. To what extent did you have a clue of what was really happening when you got the call from Jack in August of 1945 that he was being tapped as the first African-American baseball player? At what point in your life inside you do you begin to understand that this is so much bigger than the two of you, and that at the same time, it is on the two of you, it is your shoulders that are going to have to carry this? Do you understand what I'm asking you? At what point do you really become aware of the greater significance of what history has thrust upon you as a human being, as, again, this 20-something-year-old young woman?
We did not appreciate that early on. We were very caught up in our own relationship, making that work. We had decided that I had to finish college and Jack had to get a job before we could get married, so those were our own goals. And so we were very focused on what was going on between us. And we loved each other just so passionately that we thought we could do it, that as a couple, we could do anything if we were together. At some point when we got out of the initial settings, went to Montreal, went to Daytona Beach, went to other places, and we could see that people were being mistreated by the segregation policies and by the attitudes toward them, we began to see that our mission was larger than just Jack getting a job and us being a good wedded couple.
How did it make you feel?
It made you feel almost responsible in some ways. We've got to do this not just for us, but for others. Will our success translate into some change, we hoped? You have hopes and fears. And you have, you know, very mixed feelings about being in that situation because you're not sure that you're really up to it, that you really can manage it, or that you can do anything about segregation, which was a huge thing. But you begin to think, what can we do within our own circle, within our own environment, and then will that translate into something change? Mr. Ricky and Jack and I talked about that, like with that. If he succeeded, did that mean the door was open in baseball? And if the door was open in baseball, why not in other areas? So it was kind of a thing that came on us gradually and that we took on gradually when we were able to.
Bowie, did you ever resent it?
Yes, of course I resented it. I resented the way we were being treated when I understood it better, that the limited opportunities that we had were being dictated by the attitudes toward us. Yes, I resented it, but again, you know, anger and resentment can undermine your own spirit and your own ability to move forward. And so we were always moving forward.
The meeting in August with Branch Rickey is described in many ways, and your husband wrote this wonderful book, I Never Had It Made, in which he describes in very wonderful detail the conversation that he had with Branch Rickey and the now famous line, I need someone with the guts not to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackie's instinct was to fight back, and Branch Rickey was saying to him, you must be strong enough that no matter what they hurl at you and your family, you're not going to fight back for at least 2 years. That was the deal. First of all, is that story true?
That story is true, as far as I know. I wasn't sitting there.
Okay, but that's the way you...
That's the way Jack told it to me.
To the extent to which you can remember, by the way, you just celebrated your 90th birthday.
Yes, sir.
Mazel tov to you.
Thank you.
So you have a right to say I don't remember anything I ask you, but... What was his reaction when he came home and said to you, I've been told I can't fight back for 2 years? Was it something he was willing to accept easily? Did he ever say to himself, I don't know if I can do it? Did you worry that he had made this commitment?
No, he did not say he couldn't do it. At that point, there was a certain amount of desperation in his life because he had to find himself in a profession. This was a great opportunity. He wasn't going to blow it by being angry or getting into fights or doing anything that would make it difficult to carry forward. So it was, he had to think about Jack was a very religious person, and he talked to God all the time, on his knees. And he really believed that God was going to work with him, help him, support him, love him. And that was, I think, a great part of his strength. That it came from Mally, of course, his mother, because as a sharecropper, she had had the same kind of strength and had to move ahead even against all kinds of obstacles. But he thought he could do it. And then Branch Rickey's attitude was such that he invited Jack as a partner. He never said, you have to do it, we have to do it. And that made a big difference to him.
You describe, this is described by many people in many ways, the vitriol that he had to face. You got death threats. The first couple of years were very hard on you, including insults that were hurled at you, not only from the stands, but from other ball players. Even Jackie's teammates, at times, they threatened not to play with him. They were going to quit, boycott. When they slid in, they were trying to hurt him. Some pitchers tried to hit him in the head. I mean, again, we now take for granted that there are all races in Major League Baseball, but we have to remember there was only whites playing until your husband stepped on a professional baseball field and then became a Brooklyn Dodger. At any point along the way, did you ever lose hope? Did he ever lose hope? Did he ever say to you, I wish if I had a magic wand, I would change this whole thing? Did you ever say to yourself, we never should have done this?
Never. We never said that. Because there are always positive elements that you can look for. And for instance, black people started coming to the ball games. And though they were segregated in the seating arrangements, we could look down the field and we could see them nodding, waving, rejoicing. That was a source of strength for us and a source of commitment. We also had in everywhere we moved to, we had a family, a black family, that would come forward and say, come to our house for Sunday dinner. Call us if you need us. We'll babysit for you. I mean, there were things coming into us that were positive, so that it enabled us to ignore to some extent, can't really ignore totally, but some of the attacks that were coming. We got hate mail. We got one situation where they said they were going to shoot him from the stands. You have to be fearful about that. But the only real fear I had, too, one was that one of those pitchers were going to hit him in the head, and I really worried about him getting hurt physically. And the other one is that somehow it would affect his play, and then he would be out of the game. And I thought he was so important to that team that they couldn't play without him, couldn't win without him.
They couldn't. Yeah. So I'm also a baseball fan. Talk to me for a moment about what it was like for you being with the Dodgers of the late 40s and the early 50s. And there's a story, and I'm assuming it's true. I mean, I've seen pictures of it, that one of the important moments for Jackie's relationship with the team had to do with a moment with Pee Wee Reese, who was a shortstop and the captain, and Jackie started at first base, then moved to second base, and was one of baseball's greatest second basemen. But there's a moment described, Rachel, that at one point, Pee Wee Reese, at a time when people are heckling very much from the stands, comes over and puts his arm around your husband. Is that story true, and do you remember it?
The story is true. I feel that too much is made of it. That Pee Wee was a good guy, and he was from Kentucky, and the fact that he could relate to Jack in a positive way was really important to us. But I think Pee Wee got as much out of that relationship as Jack did, and I don't think that comes across when you just talk about how he put his hand on his shoulder and like saved him or something. I have a picture. I wanted people to see the picture where Jack and Pee Wee are coming off the field and they happen to be walking very close by and their hands touch. I wanted that picture to be shown because it was a mutual thing. He got as much out of it as Jack did, even though we were very pleased that he gave leadership in the team so the other fellows could come toward Jack.
In general, were the Dodgers welcoming of him once we got past that initial phase?
I would say in general, yes, at different levels. Some just, you know, hi, and some said, you know, this is how you catch a ball on first base. You know, some were closer than others. But generally speaking, he was comfortable with the team. And Branch Rickey had traded the ones who were most vocal about not wanting to play with Jack. Mm-hmm. So they weren't on the team at the time he played.
Mm-hmm. Were you a baseball fan yourself?
No, I was not a baseball fan. In college, we never went to a single baseball game. It was football and basketball were the games. So I had a lot to learn about the game. And Jack was a good teacher in terms of strategy because he thought a lot about strategy. And so I tried to catch up and understand what was important, what were the plays about, so that we could discuss it, you know.
So permit me to ask you a couple of things just so you free associate. 1951, the home run hit heard around the world when Bobby Thompson hits the home run in the final playoff game.
Yeah.
Where were you? And what was that day like for Jackie Robinson?
I was in the stands.
Were you?
When it happened. It was almost unbelievable because we were so tense and so excited about that game, and that game was so important to us. We could see ourselves getting closer to the championship. We just had to live with it as one of those major disappointments that you have in life. And We didn't get over it for weeks. We were kept talking about it. What if we'd done this? What if we'd done that? But we were all really upset by that and not celebrating the fact that he hit it.
Yes. You understand that for us who are fans, we often have a romanticized notion of what it's like for the ball player himself. Very few fans ever say to themselves, it's their job. People go to their job. And by the way, you work in an office. There are many people who are around you. You know them. You like them. You say hello to them. You may have no social interaction with them once you leave the office. And in baseball teams travel together. That's true. But very oftentimes, you have your life. You go to the ballpark to play a game. Mm-hmm. That's your job. The game is over. You go home.
Right.
Were there any ball players as part of the Dodgers who became important to you off the field?
A few. We did not socialize with the teammates that much. And I would say Gil Hodges and his wife, Joan, and Carl Erskine and his wife and Pee-wee and Dottie were probably the three that we saw the most of. Now, we also had Don Newcomb, and we had
Roy Campanella.
Roy Campanella, the black players who came in. And but we weren't invited to their homes for parties, and we never invited them to our homes. Mm-hmm. We had meals with the ones I mentioned occasionally, but it was like a business. You know,
exactly.
It was a business relationship.
And how about the relationship with the opposing teams? And again, when you were a Brooklyn Dodger fan, you hated the Giants, and you hated Leo Durocher. And, you know, for me, who a passionate Jackie Robinson fan, I was very upset with the way the Giants treated him. And there was the incidents with Davey Williams at first base and Leo Durocher in general. Was the fan experience of the rivalry between the Dodgers and the Giants the same for you?
Oh, they were the enemy.
They
of
were.
Of course. Just like the Yankees became the enemy when, in other situations,
yes,
when playing the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could hate them, and it was okay. And that's part of being a fan, is to have your loyalty to your team and your love of your team, and your all of your aspirations are connected to your team, but you didn't want anything good to happen to your enemy.
Outside the game, do you and Jackie Robinson ever become friendly with ball players who were on the other, were a Giants or a Yankee?
No.
No, that didn't happen.
It only happened
then after he retired.
After he retired.
Okay.
Yes.
Very, very interesting. Okay. Rachel, your life has not been easy. You have always maintained a grace and dignity, but your life has not been easy. And as successful as Jackie Robinson's career was, as thrilling as it was, there were very, very hard times for you. And you've had hard experiences as a human being in life as a whole. And you write about the chapter on how you lost your oldest son, Jackie Jr., who was killed in a car accident on the Merritt Parkway, and how you understand none of us who are parents can ever, I mean, I just want to hug you to death. I mean, I'm so sorry. I don't know how you lose a child and keep going. I don't know how. And you write very movingly about that. Jackie comes down with a serious illness and has to deal with that in life. And then he dies very, very, very young. And you have a long life after he dies. And you had to build your own life and your own home. And we talked about them, and you were living in Stamford at the time. I ended up a rabbi in Stamford. And you had this wonderful home, and you had these jazz festivals, and everybody was at your home, and it was wonderful, and then it's gone. And I wanted to know where the strength comes, and whether you can talk at all about how a human being endures and transcends the kinds of pain you've had to live with at times in your life.
I actually feel very blessed. I feel that, yes, I've had to live with tragedy and with loss and with really terrible things. But also, I've had experiences that, and relationships that have made me ready for what was coming. I passionately love Jack, and I always felt that, gosh, this is so wonderful, and it did something for both my spirit and for my sense of myself, because I felt adored by him. And that I also had that feeling from my parents. Rachel can do anything, get going and do it. So there was a lot of structure, a lot of strength that came from my relationships. We suffered through, my mother, Jackie Jr. died in 71, Jack died in 72, and my mother died in 73. It was the worst period of my life, and I didn't know that I could really come out of that. I really just went down for a short period of time. But it was a short period of time because I knew I had to get up and get going, you know, somehow. And that's when we founded the Jackie Robinson Foundation. We, my friends and I said, what can we do to keep Jack's legacy alive? And if we work on that, maybe we'll feel better. We'll feel closer to him. And so that's how that the organization began and how I recovered as we began to help these young people get educated.
Mm-hmm. We should mention, by the way, you have two other children who are very successful in their own right. Mm-hmm. Sharon followed your example is in nursing. Mm-hmm. And your son David is in Africa?
Yes, Tanzania, Africa.
And incidentally, there are times when you also have yourself wanted to in some way identify with and strengthen the ties of the African-American community here to your African roots. Do I have that right?
Yes.
So you must be proud of both of your children.
I'm very proud of them. Sharon has also become an author. She's a children's book author.
Oh, how lovely.
And she's published 6 books. And they're really interesting books. And children are writing to me about the books of Sharon. And David has started a coffee cooperative in his village in Tanzania.
Amazing.
He has 400 small farmers who pool their coffee. He imports it to the United States, has it processed here, and they sell it here. Money goes back to the co-op. So both of them are in wonderful positions and also still following sort of the family tradition of giving back.
It must make you very proud.
I am very proud of them.
Can I ask, did you and Jackie have any feelings about the Jewish community? And I ask you that because you write how one of, I believe I've got this right, 1949, you have your first two-bedroom apartment on Tilden Avenue in Brooklyn, and you meet the Satlows, and you talk about Archie and Sarah and their 3 children. You also talk about how at Grossinger's you become very good friends with B and Andre Baruch. Mm-hmm. And then in Stanford, you write about Andrea Simon, and you also talk about how when Jack died, it was Sidney Queskin who came over and helped you. And, mm-hmm. and the Queskins, of course, have created wonderful things in Stanford, and they have the Queskin Theater, where I've been privileged to perform. In general, did you find support in any way, or did the Jewish community, did you feel, give the revolution you were trying to create support? In what way did you feel that the Jewish community either was or was not supportive of enough of Jackie Robinson in particular and the civil rights movement in general?
I don't know that I can talk about the Jewish community per se, but I've always had very good Jewish friends, and they've been extremely important to me. Marty Edelman, who is my best friend right now, has been with me for the last 20-some years. Sarah, the Simrats, she's 93 years old, living in Florida. She and I are still close. As individuals, I love them, and they love me, and we were strengthened. I always felt that the Jewish people had similar experiences to mine. And so there was no difference there in that sense, that we know that they're going through some of the same things we're going through. They will understand me better, and I can really understand them. And they've come to my rescue. When we moved to Tilden Avenue, Sarah and her husband came over. There was some kind of document being circulated to keep us out of the neighborhood. And Sarah came over and introduced herself to me and said, listen, we're in the neighborhood and we're with you on this. And of course, it was mutual because I was very excited to have her come forward and to offer her help. So it's, for me, it's been close ties with the Jewish community. Mm-hmm.